And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT, just like the man said, 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. With me is Phil Conlon.
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
That's Phil Conlon of Classical Underground, 6 to 8 on Wednesdays. And today we're going to talk to David Hoyle, Dr. David Hoyle. He was with the Africa Research Center and has spent many years actually working on the issue, particular region of Africa, the Sudan, Egypt, elsewhere, but he's certainly an authority on the subject of modern Sudan, and we want to find out what is going on there because there's been a dramatic shift of power. So we're going to be speaking with Dr. Hoyle, and we will also talk today at a halfway point, probably about 5:30, with Zafar Bengash, about this dramatic seizure of an Iranian vessel in the waters close to Gibraltar. And that is being called piracy by the Iranian government, and it is it was done, we understand, at the request of the U.S. government. The U.S. asked the Canadian government to arrest a Huawei executive, and we did that. And the Americans asked the British to capture an Iranian vessel, and they did that. Vessel almost rhymes with vassal. That will be your clue word for the rest of the show. I think, we're going to be speaking very shortly with Professor Hoyle. I think he's on the line. David Hoyle, are you there?
Good evening. Yes, indeed. Hi, Phil.
It's very nice to talk to you, David. It's been a while, and we used to speak, and our listeners will remember with you, going way back to when, years ago, there was a so-called Darfur crisis. It seemed to have come and gone, and
that's right.
It looms in the background, I guess, of the current issue, at least when Americans and the British leaders talk, they bring it up. So I guess I'm going to hand it to you as the issue. There's been a change of power. President Bashir has been removed by the army following demonstrations. Then we've gone into a period of the demonstrations seem to be unhappy with the army not becoming a civilian government. What is going on there?
Well, it's actually very, very confusing on many levels. You have a change, obviously, in power now within Khartoum. And there was one or two very fleeting heads of state after the fall of President al-Bashir. As you mentioned correctly, he was actually, in effect, removed actually from power by the military, the army, and also a very powerful a paramilitary bloc who were basically made up of essentially militias who were called the Rapid Support Force,
yes,
who had emerged within Sudan in the last 5 or 6 years. Many of them actually were paramilitaries who had moved away from Darfur once the crisis in Darfur was over, many of whom had then been fighting on behalf of Saudi Arabia in Yemen as part of the Saudi coalition of which Sudan had been a part. So this broad coalition of the military and paramilitary were the people who removed President Bashir from office. You've now seen the emergence of the militia leader, the General Hameti, as in effect the power broker, the man behind the throne, or in fact the man actually on the throne now, really, within Sudan, which of course has not pleased the civil society elements that actually were behind the protests which led to the downfall of al-Bashir. And of course, I don't think elements of the military are particularly happy that their government's now being led by a paramilitary leader. So it's very, very confusing. And on top of that, you also have a number of of regional interests being played out, because General Hameti is actually very much aligned with Saudi Arabia, as mm-hmm. mentioned, on whose behalf he commanded forces in the conflict in Yemen.
Yeah. And so this would not be the outcome that the civilians, or the population of Sudan, was hoping for when they entered this contest.
Well, I think it's always hard to actually talk in terms of, you know, the civilians or the population of Sudan. I think you have a range of interests. What you did have, who were very, very vocal and very active on social media and very much in the Western media spotlight, were, you know, sort of several thousand protesters who I'd actually sort of classify as the Facebook generation. The difficulty with that is very often, you know, they may well be the people who initiate change in a country, but they mm-hmm. are very seldom at the end of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And it's usually guys with, technicals and heavy machine guns on top of them that are the people who actually are in charge at the end of that movement. And I think that's now the case in Sudan. And it's still comparatively early days as to exactly which way things are going. But the military, the men with guns, the men on horses are in charge.
Mm. We're speaking to David Hoyle, who has written about Sudan extensively. He's with the Africa Research Center. And David, there's a suggestion. Well, I should say, I was looking at headlines. They say that Bashir got into difficulties. He got in when he could not straddle the problem of contending Gulf state powers. The United Arab Emirates, I understand it, were not happy, or were, actually, I don't know which one was unhappy or happy, but he was talking about leaving Sudan, and this contributed to his problems. Is that right?
I think he actually had a number of problems, some of which were domestic. The major motivating factor, I think, was actually domestic, and that was the economy. Although he and his government had become a very closely aligned with Washington, Washington actually continued to list Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. It lifted every other sanction it had in place, except for that one listing, which I thought was never actually rightly conveyed in the first place. They should never have been on that list. But nonetheless, they were on that list since 1997, and they continue to be on the list, despite all the help and cooperation in counterterrorism, which they've been involved in. Anyway, this meant that, in effect, Sudan could not lend any money whatsoever on the international money markets. No bank, no financial institution, or the IMF or the World Bank, would lend Sudan a single cent. This, in effect, eventually led to a spiral in the economy, and bread prices went up, fuel prices went up. That was the essence, I think, of the unrest, which you actually saw in a number of urban areas mm-hmm. within Sudan. So that's the key thing. And you also did have the fact that he'd been, in power for far too long. There's no doubt about that. But that also was linked into the fact that he had been indicted by the ICC, the mm-hmm. International Criminal Court. And one reason why he stayed in power as long as he did was because you have head of state immunity mm-hmm. from the ICC if you are in power. So, those are two factors. And then, of course, also on top of that, he was always seen, the government was always seen as being actually pro-Qatar. Mm-hmm. And there was an alignment, I think, actually politically, really, between Qatar and the government of Sudan as led by Bashir. That, of course, actually annoyed and angered the Saudis and other people in the Emirates. So mm-hmm. that's also one other factor. And the man now in charge, as I mentioned, General Hameti, is very much a Saudi and Emirati man.
Is this General Dagalo? Dagalo?
Hermeti, yes. He's known as.
That's a nickname. What is it? When they say he has, is there some special meaning to that name?
Not really. I mean, I think he has a number of names, and you know, it's just one of them. Maybe a nom de guerre.
Noms de guerre.
Yeah.
They say that this agreement, and I wonder how stable it could be. They say that it's just recently resolved. They said that the key players in bringing it about was, number one, the United States, and then the Britain, and the UAE, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Is that the case? And that really sounds like a formula that.
well, you're right. It's,
for trouble.
It looks like a unworkable melange of interest groups there and countries. You know, they've already been through a number of agreements and, you know, understandings and things, none of which have actually worked out as yet. And I can't see how this would also, you know, last actually very long. There are expectations that will not be met by this government. Mm-hmm. You know, the European Union has its own expectations. The British government, obviously the American government, the people on the streets, the several thousand, you know, Facebook, you know, generation people, also have their own expectations. And with the best will in the world, which may well be absent mm-hmm. in Khartoum, I don't think it's those wishes are going to be met.
Yeah, I read that they part of the agreement is that there will be elections will be held 3 years from now. And for the first 21 months of this coalition involving civilians in the army, that the army will be in charge for the first 21 months.
Yes. Yeah. That's actually, yeah. Well, now, having mentioned all
great.
That, of course, the
if I was out there in the streets demonstrating, I'd say, that's what we got from this.
you've had a change of power, and I have to say, in all the years, the 30-odd years of a President al-Bashir, you never saw the sort of street violence that you saw actually from the military or the paramilitaries, as you saw recently in Khartoum this year. So, you know, I always be careful of what you wish for, mm-hmm. and you know, I think they may well be an example of the law of unintended consequences being visited upon the Sudanese, because it's you know, no one knows what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I'm as interested as anyone, and yeah. You know, I think there's
that. We turn to you because you know the most, and you're not sure. So that you're making us all nervous.
We're all nervous. I think everyone's nervous. You know, it's a very volatile situation. You could get a full scale civil war breaking out. You could get, you know, very violent differences of opinion within the government itself, within the military, within the paramilitaries. On top of that, yes. Of course, also you have a number of existing rebel movements in Darfur, not least of which in Darfur, in what's now South Sudan, the southern borders of what's now Sudan, and of course also in the east. And mm-hmm. on top of that, you know, you have a number of international powers who are continuing with their ambition to actually further break up the existing, you know.
Actually, this state. New government of Ethiopia involved itself.
Yes, everyone's getting involved. I think you'll have a lot more trouble also probably coming from rebel groups that are now based in what's now the new state of South Sudan. You'll have rebel movements, I think, in Chad as well. They're gearing up for more trouble in Darfur. So you have a number of forces at play here, many of which are actually invisible at this moment in time. They're actually sort of making their own preparations.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to David Hoyle, Africa Research Center. I really urge you to Google David and learn more about all this, particularly the background and great writing on the International Criminal Court, by the way. But, David, I've seen speculation. Well, they use a term about these forces of the general that you referred to, Mr. Dagalo, that some describe them as mercenaries, that there's money involved in sending, I don't know how many, 14,000, they say, have gone to Yemen. But there's also talk about their being put to use in support of the Saudi-backed general in Libya. Have you heard that?
Yes, I mean, these are essentially paramilitaries who became surplus to requirements in Darfur. The actual war in Darfur, you know, you can say ended in effect in 2004. So about 14, 15 years ago, the war ended there. You've nonetheless actually had a number of militias and tribal militias and paramilitary groups within Darfur, who was broadly a pro-government. These were then used, as I mentioned earlier, these were then used as the Sudanese a contribution to the Saudi alliance that was actually fighting in Yemen. So you have, you know, a number of thousand paramilitaries or military men who you know, may well be used elsewhere. Of course, the war continues in Yemen. It's not going, you know, anywhere at the moment. So I don't think they'll be moved around, you know, soonish. I think they'll be there for a while still. But you do have there is no shortage of men and guns, men of violence in Sudan, and you know, the border, as in Africa, so in general, the borders are very, very porous. So I've no doubt there are Sudanese paramilitaries operating in Libya, probably in Chad and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the picture we paint is one that is clearly is a crisis. It looks like it's actually only beginning from the sound of it. What kind of things... You've been following sort of the spokespersons. We don't seem to have much of a picture of who these demonstrators have been and who is speaking. There seemed to have been an attempt to divide them. Some of them said talk to the army. Some of them did not.
That's right.
Have you got an idea of roughly who some of them are and what they want?
Yes, I think, I mean, the essence of these protesters are... You know, youngish, often middle-class, you know, professionals within Sudan, within the urban areas of Sudan, specifically also within Khartoum, who'd not be, you know, so unlike their counterparts elsewhere in the world, and they've also built on this grassroots unease with the economic conditions within Sudan itself. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, many of them are very, very articulate, they're very well educated, very much the Facebook generation I mentioned earlier. Exactly how much power they have, how much, you know, popular support they have, is unclear. The media, and especially the Western media, of course, has actually, you know, magnified their visual image and their presence and their, you know, their message, but not necessarily in keeping with exactly, you know, how powerful they are, or might not be within the country itself.
How much of a factor has the issue of following the dictates of Gulf states had to do with what they talk about? Do they raise that? Is that a primary thing in their mind?
Yes, it is, because I think, you know, many of these Facebook generation, you know, anything linked in with Saudi Arabia is you know, not welcome. So, you know, there's a very clear unease, I think, amongst that particular generation and those people on the streets in Khartoum about that link. But that's a very, very strong link with the present government.
So one would assume that will keep emerging, particularly if the Saudis get their way entirely with that army. I mean, they certainly want to use those forces in Yemen, right?
Well, they continue to do so, but I think their eyes now on the bigger picture, because if they do assert their dominance within Sudan, it's a zero-sum game for Qatar. Qatar then loses, you know, its last real link or area of influence within Africa. So, you know, and I think at many levels, that's also the conflict now being fought in Sudan, or more specifically within Khartoum. Mm. It's a battle also between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. As you know, there's been a virtual war fought between Qatar and Saudi and the Emirates.
Yes.
For 2 years or more now, and yes, that's one of the big dynamics now within this conflict in Sudan.
Uh-huh. Well, David Hoyle, it's great we could talk to you. It sounds to me like we're going to have to get back to you sometime soon. I hope we can do that.
Anytime, Phil. Anytime. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, David.
Not at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. That's David Hoyle, and he knows whereof he speaks, and he's been writing about the matter, lived there, worked there in Sudan, and longtime listeners of the Taylor Report will remember him. We used to cover the issue of Darfur with him, quite well versed in all these things. We have some Sudanese music, and then we'll be back.